During MKUltra, the CIA was experimenting with LSD and even wrote an assassination manual. They also studied how to erase guilt and instill obedience while dreaming of turning humans into programmable machines. In part two of our MKUltra deep dive, we follow CIA agent William Buckley, a man who watched the program from the inside and became terrified of what he saw. Doctors breaking minds through electroshock and psychic driving, manuals teaching how to kill someone and make it look like an accident, and a secret pivot towards MKUltra, hypnosis, demonology, and brain implants, and something that sounds a lot like Neuralink. So join me as we dive into the book, Secrets and Lies, that details the occult subprogram called Operation Often, here on Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. Now, if you followed me, you already listened to part one, right? We explained what MKUltra was, talked about pop culture, the examples from movies, some celebrities affiliated with it. We talked about David McGowan's book, Program to Kill. So if you haven't listened to part one, go listen to part one. But today we're talking about Secrets and Lies, a book by Gordon Thomas. And this is primarily a book through the lens of William Buckley, a CIA agent. And we're going to talk about different key players a little bit of MKUltra, Dr. Jolly West, Dr. William Sargent, Dr. Ewan Cameron, Frank Olson, Alan Dulles. And we get introduced to some of these techniques they would use called psychic driving. And they even have an assassination manual in the book, if you can believe that. And then next episode, we're going to go into part three, where we look at a different book called Poisoner in Chief that focuses on Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, the guy who's running MKUltra. We're going to talk about George Hunter White, Operation Midnight Climax, and all these nerds trying to get laid. Then in part four, our final show, we're going to talk about Kathy O'Brien's Transformation of America, where we get into the themes of Project Monarch, and we talk about Charles Manson being involved, so on and so forth. Now, but today, like I said, today is all about secrets and lies, okay?
Now, this book
is a meaty book, all right? And much like the other books, the service I provide to you, whether you like it or not, I guess, would be that I'm going to pull out what I find to be the most intriguing and interesting elements of MKUltra. In part one, I gave you the breakdown of what MKUltra basically was, based on the official sources. So you kind of know the whole story, kind of, right? But what I want to do with my series is I'm going to go through this book. I'm going to pull out some interesting notes. Obviously, we can't go through the whole book line by line. This would be a many, many hours, right? I want to get you in and out in less than 45 minutes, if I can. And that's the goal of this series, is to pull out some interesting aspects. And each episode, we're going to learn a little bit more about MKUltra, but we're going to kind of rehash some of the same material at the same time. So that by the end, you've got a well-rounded coverage from official sources and some conspiracy sources on what MKUltra was, because we don't really know, right? We don't know because they destroyed all the documentation. Kind of like the Epstein files. Like, we're not getting those. So let's get into this book, Secrets and Lies. The book is information fed to the writer Gordon Thomas from CIA agent William Buckley, who was part of MKUltra. He didn't like what he saw, even though he stuck around the CIA afterward, after the program was shut down. Now, Buckley was officially a State Department employee at foreign embassies. Apparently, that's how they do it. This is like common cover for CIA agents, is to put them in the State Department. But the author became friends with Buckley, and he proceeds to obtain, he says, 22,000 documents about MKUltra. He obtains Buckley's testimony about MKUltra, which is in the whole book. And this was all before Buckley would ultimately be killed in a CIA operation after being taken hostage in Beirut. So let's go through the book. In chapter one, we're introduced to some of the doctors behind this. Dr. Louis Jolyon West, a.k.a. Jolly. We got Dr. William Sargent. These are two main components of MKUltra. They were both holding close relationships and connections between CIA and MI6. Sargent wrote a book called Battle for the Mind, and that's a book that people involved with interrogations apparently study. And these doctors, what they were doing was they were trying to study and focus on how you could break someone's will through, you know, drugs, hypnosis, psychosurgery, electroshock, forms of behavioral control. Then we've got Frank Olson. He was the CIA agent who also didn't love what the CIA was doing with MKUltra, right? That should be your first clue that none of this is good. Because a lot of people involved, a lot of patriots involved were like, I don't really dig this, man. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this stuff. Maybe we shouldn't be filling up the punch bowls with LSD to people who don't know that there's drugs in it. Because the CIA was doing all kinds of horrific stuff, including RAPE, right? But it's always, you know, in the name of national security, scared of the commies, right? But anyway, Frank Olson's the one who died after supposedly jumping from a window. We talked about this in part one. Plot spoiler, he was killed. His son Eric would investigate his father's death many years later and have the body exhumed, and it revealed the truth, which was that he was bludgeoned in accordance with the suggestions made in the CIA assassination manual, which again, if you get this book, Secrets and Lies, you can read the whole manual. I've got a few sentences I pulled out because by the time you get to that point, you kind of understand what they're talking about, right? But it's got in the center of the book here, it's got the full assassination manual. If you're watching this on my YouTube, I just showed it to you. And if you're not watching on YouTube, go to, you know, if you're on that free feed status, get on the YouTube. You might as well watch the video. Add occult symbolism. Like and subscribe. Give me to 100,000 by the end of the year, and I'll not mention it again. Now, Eric Olson also did some FOIA requests, and he received the CIA assassination manual, and it's 8 pages. This book was the first time it was published, which is probably why it's hard to find the book. It's not impossible. I mean, you can find it. It's just like it's not reprinted or nothing. And it's interesting because the book talks about the history of assassination and where that comes from. And sure enough, it's Illuminati firm. It goes back to the Assassins, a secret society group in the Middle East that derived its name from hashish. The hashish used by Hassani Sabah, where he would drug out his character, followers. Kind of like MKUltra, right? Like he would dose them to go do assassinations politically, murders, and those kinds of things, right? And the tradition used to be, and it still is to this day, that all assassination orders are shared orally. They're never written down. They're never recorded. There's only one person involved. And this is interesting because I ironically just watched JFK for the first time since I remember watching it when it came out, but I probably didn't pay any attention. It's a long ass movie, 3.5 hours, but they actually literally say this in the movie about how to assassinate someone. Like you don't write it down, and they didn't do that. Right. But the best technique as opposed to JFK. So JFK was like a public ritual, right? And I believe that based on King Kill 33. But if you're talking about just subtly taking someone out without the public ritual aspect, the best technique is to make it look like an accident. Another one is to make it look like they overdosed on drugs. And, you know, this opens up a whole can of worms. Now, William Buckley, Bill, you know, nicknamed Bill, old Bill Buckley, he was another CIA agent who didn't like what he saw, just like Frank Olson. And Buckley tells the author, and I quote, "It's the dream of any intelligence service to be able to control someone's mind." Now, isn't that fun? Isn't that fun? Isn't that plug us into the theories of the Dark Enlightenment and the technocracy with the AI surveillance state? They want to deduce us through AI algorithms to understand what we want, think, and do, so they can predict our behavior so they can then control us. All right. Now, Bill said that Sidney Gottlieb's obsession, he's got an obsession. He's working on a man with a long hair and a tan. Bill Buckley said that Sidney Gottlieb, the guy who was running MKUltra, and his obsession was to, quote, turn ordinary human beings into robotic figures whose value systems could be so altered that they would even kill on command and then be programmed to forget who had given the order. He labored to make science fiction into science fact. Now, this claim would be corroborated by the next book I'm going to talk about in part three, Poisoner in Chief, all about Sidney Gottlieb. These nerds, always obsessed with science fiction. You know, I have a theory on life and about all of our pain and suffering and AI. You've got these introverted nerds, and look, I can say it because I am an introverted nerd. Always have been, always will be, believe it or not. Introverted nerds, we escape into the other reality of science fiction. And we want that to be real. We want it to be real. That's why I went up to Washington to go to where Twin Peaks was filmed, because I want it to be real. Why? I don't know. I don't know why it is. You find solace in this other world and you want it to be real. That's what Disney World does. That's why there's Avatar Land. You know, it's all this stuff. And these nerds become obsessed with science fiction. That's what got us into Jack Parsons and Wernher von Braun and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. That's what got all these early astrophysicists and rocket scientists interested in trying to go to the moon and Mars. And Elon Musk, we're going to be on Mars by now, by the way. Just so you know. Anyway, we'll talk about that more in part three. We got CIA Director William Colby. He was the whistleblower on MKUltra. He was the first one to ever disclose agency secrets of CIA. He broke Omerta, right? The mob code of silence. Because he learned about Gottlieb's experiments, which were so horrendous. He also was like, you know what? I'm drawing the line here, nerds. Gottlieb's CIA department was creating mind-altering drugs. They were creating weapons. They had a wristwatch that could blow off someone's hand. That sounds really familiar, doesn't it? Man, what does that remind me of? Remember that other group of intelligence people that had the exploding pagers? Oh, man. Remember old Charlie Kay's lapel mic? Oh, man. I mean, these all sound very familiar. And this is back in the 60s. So Gottlieb, a very enigmatic character, he was Jewish, right? But he experimented with many religions, Catholicism, Buddhism, agnosticism. He was into anything. It's said in the book that he slept 5 hours a night, that he went to foreign countries to learn about their local traditions, like Anthony Bourdain or something. he would go to tribes in Colombia where he learned about drugs used, like some drugs they would use to prepare virgins for human sacrifice. So yes, he was looking into this. He even brought some samples back to Langley. There was a leaf that he brought back that could kill a cattle quicker than a stun gun, and so on. Bill Buckley, he grew up in the 1930s in Massachusetts. He joins the Army in 1945, becomes an officer, gets a Silver Star, Purple Heart, Korean War, all the stuff, right? Gets stationed at the Pentagon to do documentation about the Korean War. And he reads these classified documents that really intrigue him, right? He reads about Air Force pilots who became prisoners of war in North Korea, and the Chinese apparently got them to say that they had falsely dropped biological weapons. And the U.S. government denies it, like, hey, we didn't do that, right? Because that probably violates the Geneva Conventions, I'm guessing, right? But either way, the U.S. government's like, no, these guys were brainwashed into saying this stuff. And the term brainwashing is something that was first invented in September 1950 in a Miami newspaper where Edward Hunter wrote an article that says brainwashing tactics force Chinese into ranks of Communist Party. Turns out this writer, Hunter, was an undercover CIA officer faking as an author writing books on this subject. So a little bit of Operation Mockingbird at play there. Then we got Dr. William Sargent. He was a psychiatrist who wrote the book Battle for the Mind. He worked for MI5, MI6. And participated in their own version of MKUltra. They were doing electroshock therapy and so on. So the CIA, Alan Dulles, they send Gottlieb and Frank Olson to monitor Dr. Sargent's test, and they all become close friends. Now, like all these nerds, Dr. Sargent, big time freak, freak of the week. It says in the book he had a, quote, voracious sexual appetite. And he was married, but he would go to swinger parties. He told his old lady, he's like, you can't keep up with my drive. I'm out. And you know, this is the 50s, right? Women didn't have the same kind of representation they do today. So she, I guess she just had to deal with it. I don't know. But anyways, it's 1954 now. MKUltra has officially started with the CIA. Gottlieb personally hires Bill Buckley to work in his MKUltra program. And here we get the definition of MK, something you hear a lot from a variety of people, and I'm going to guess that this is the correct answer to what that means. MK means it's the current project. That's what it means. Ultra is chosen because it was a reminder of one of the World War II's most secret projects, the program which broke the German codes to the U-boats. I think Nick Cage did that, didn't he, in a movie? And this was intended on cracking the code of how the Chinese brainwashed those Air Force pilots because the Soviets started doing it. So, yeah, that's where it comes from the U-boats and MK, meaning the current program. So in 1955, a report on the project was... A report on the project was to put the surveillance equipment into an animal to try to get... Let me back up. There was a project, and a report was found that apparently what they were doing was trying to set up surveillance through a cat, right? And what they did was they took a cat, and in his tail they put an antenna. In his cochlea, in his ear, they put a recorder. And they set it off to, like, try to get it to go spy on, you know, whatever, the mob. I don't know what they were doing. But the cat would just walk off, and it would get hungry, and they were like, man, we can't control this cat. Of course, you can't control a cat. That's crazy. And one time, the project ended when the cat crossed the road in a taxi, ran it over. So, rest in peace, Purple Heart to the, or Gold Star to the cat, I guess. Now, every agent... In the CIA, this time, when they went overseas, they had to take a copy of the CIA assassination manual with them in case they needed it, which is in the book, right? And we'll talk about what it contains here and there throughout this series. So Buckley, he's reading the MK Ultra case files, and he finds out about this Dr. Cameron, Ewan Cameron, who was very radical. And he was looking at how you could give someone enough of a drug that it would do a lobotomy on the person. He was testing stuff on patients without warning of any side effects that were coming their way. It goes through a few examples of some of these patients who were victims of these maniacs. One patient was Madeline LaCroix, and she suffered all kinds of crazy abuse. She had to wear a helmet where they would whisper in her ear and drive her mad. They called this depatterning or psychic driving. And they would heavily medicate her, electroshocker, all this stuff, right? And the reason she was trying to get help was because she had issues with schizophrenia. And what was interesting is that she said with the schizophrenia, she felt like these people called the wise men were spying on her, which I found curious because that's also the name of the Majestic 12, is the wise men. I mean, that's kind of weird, right? So the psychic driving was described in the book. And as what they would do is they would play back a recorded tape session to break down her natural defenses, right? And in her case, they would replay her talking about sex fantasies she had with her own father. And it sounds a lot like desensitization or exposure therapy of some kind. So Buckley spells out how they would get people to make confessions because, you know, again, this is all related to interrogation, a lot of the stuff. In the book, he says, the Chinese and I suspect the Soviets have grasped the importance of inducing a sense of guilt and internal conflict in a prisoner. They would have achieved this by subjecting the man to a bombardment of accusations and continuous cross-examinations until his anxiety leaves him totally confused and he contradicts himself on some small point. This is then used as a psychological stick to beat him with. The end result is that his brain ceases to function normally. Eventually, the prisoner mentally collapses. At that state, he is in a highly suggestible state. His previous thought patterns have been removed. He is ready with little more prompting to deliver the desired confession. And Dr. Ewan Cameron was the one behind a lot of these studies. And these techniques, what they were doing was they were focusing on fomenting anxiety in a person or feelings of guilt, whether it was real or imagined, and create this conflict of loyalties to break them to a confession, which you see a lot in a lot of these crime documentaries. What was that one on Netflix where they questioned this mentally handicapped guy for hours and hours and hours? Anyways, they do these techniques. So it's like, man, I don't know. I would lawyer up. I would plead the fifth as always get a lawyer. Because they use these techniques, man, because they just want to like move on to the next thing, right? Sometimes they're not necessarily worried about, I mean, this is just my personal opinion. Like, I think sometimes they're not so much worried about getting the right person as they are getting a person. And they would use these techniques, right? That's why you see them interrogate these people for 12, 15, 16 hours, right? You got to break them. And again, we're talking about the physiological mechanics that Ewan Cameron believed would produce these results and how strikingly similar these were to the behavior patterns implanted by various Puritan preachers of New England. And they and all these people in the CIA had these Calvinistic type beliefs, and they made a practice of inducing guilt, right? It was the first stage of conversion, was guilt and shame. So Buckley was researching Dr. Ewan Cameron and found a copy of the book 1984, which has parallels to different mind control efforts, which I found obviously interesting because we did a three-part 1984 book club last year. It says in the book, he was especially fascinated by Orwell's 1984 because he had noticed a copy of the novel on one of Dr. Cameron's bookshelves. Central to the book is the story of how the hero, while being indoctrinated, reveals he has an overwhelming fear of rats dating from his childhood. The revelation is used by his interrogator to procure the hero's acceptance of Big Brother. And isn't that what we go through on a daily basis with the news and the mainstream media and social media? Is this digital battleground for the mind. It's spiking your mind with fears so you accept and in fact encourage Big Brother surveillance states and those kinds of things. Now, Buckley noted, quote, Orwell had created something that is very close to the methods used by Cameron. His papers indicate he is always on the lookout in a patient for something for which he or she is sensitive. He plays on these fears, ostensibly because he insisted he is trying to banish them. But by making a patient confront a fear, Cameron could also bring them more under his control and more ready to accept his suggestions. So again, fear, very powerful. And these psychopaths know that. That is arguably what they use to get their way through coordination of the press and the media and pop culture and all these things. We find the history of the names of the projects, the predecessors to MKUltra, including Bluebird, Artichoke, Naomi, and of course MKUltra, right? Now those names come from Sidney Gottlieb's most favorite bird and vegetable, artichoke and bluebird. So, or sing like a bluebird was, you know, that was the idea because it was all about a truth serum. And Naomi, that was a distant cousin of his. I guess his favorite one. I don't know. Now, eventually they ended up numbering all these sub projects because there were so many of them. All right. Buckley spends a lot of time hanging out with Dr. Sargent. Learns about the Chinese brainwashing the Air Force, which to me sounded a lot like basic training in the military. I'll read you from the book. It says, in the Institute's projection room, Dr. Cameron and Buckley watched the newsreel footage of U.S. prisoners of war in North Korea. Dr. Wolf's voice explained that each man was initially held in solitary confinement, usually in complete darkness. The only contact with the outside world was through his guards when they fed him, usually once a day. Each meal was accompanied by acts of humiliation. The guards made a prisoner eat his food standing up and then urinate lying down. When he was allowed to sleep, a prisoner was awakened whenever he made the slightest movement. Slowly but steadily, Dr. Wolf's voice intoned, the prisoner finds the stress so unbearable that he breaks down. He weeps. He mutters aloud. He prays for God to save him, then curses God for failing to do so. And like I said, this sounds rings similar to basic training experiences, because they do mess with you in many ways, like sleep deprivation, food deprivation, all that kind of stuff. Dr. Cameron continued to write notes while Dr. Wolf explained what followed this initial stage. The prisoner is taken for interrogation. He is not confronted with any specific crimes. Instead, he is told he knows what they are. If he wishes to share them with the interrogator, he can, but the prisoner doesn't know what to share. He doesn't know what his specific crime is. Slowly but surely, he is driven ever deeper into his own mental mire. After weeks of this, the prisoner was ready for what Dr. Wolf said his captors called re-education. To achieve that meant the prisoner must confess. To make a confession, the prisoner must be properly prepared. That requires he studies Marx and Mao, attends lectures, and engages in self-criticism. As he developed these new skills, the prisoner has the pressure eased on him. His interrogators show their esteem. They reward him with extra food, a hot drink, another blanket. And so concluded Dr. Wolf, every prisoner had been led to stand before a camera and denounce all he had once cherished. Buckley was to recall that Dr. Cameron sat for a long moment in silence. And then he says, we need to replicate what was done to those prisoners. We must not only replicate it, but do it better, much better. And that's kind of how basic training worked. So I was the dorm chief in Air Force basic training, and me and the element leader, there was four element leaders and me, the dorm chief, and we had to memorize. I remember we had to memorize this like long list of responsibilities, like verbatim. And again, it's like if you get anything wrong a little bit, you get punished. But if you do it right, you get the little extra perk or whatever, right? You get a little attaboy from the drill sergeant. So anyway, Dulles, Alan Dulles, he was also buds with Dr. Cameron back during World War II. And Dulles was, again, one of the founders of the OSS in 1942. And he was really into spreading disinformation about Nazis, like saying Hitler had one testicle and Goering was into, you know, he was a PDF file. And Dulles actually helped set up Operation Paperclip then to bring these same Nazis to America. So Frank Olson, they tell the story about how he dies, and Dulles immediately tries to cover it up. He calls the police commissioner in New York to tell him to do a news blackout on Olson's death. And he's like, hey, if it's too late for the news blackout, make sure we distance Olson from the CIA as much as possible. Again, trying to manipulate the media. Dulles then calls Frank's wife to lie to her and tell her how depressed Frank had been. And this is why JFK fired his ass when he got in the office, which is probably why what happened to JFK happened to JFK. The Japanese, they had a much larger biological program than America did at the time. So America's like, we need to up our numbers, you know. They had 6,000 scientists at 18 institutes, and they would experiment on the Allied prisoners of war, right? They would do horrific things. They would force them to eat rice with botulism. They would inject them with brucellosis. They would breathe in anthrax. They would inject them with tetanus, inject them with smallpox, bubonic plague. They would dissect their victims while they were still alive to see what effects the toxins were having on their organs. Crazy stuff. And like I'm going to talk about, I think in part three, if our enemies were doing this stuff, I mean, should we stoop to that level or no? I mean, if there's bad guys doing bad stuff, like, do we need to stoop to their level? I mean, I'd have to hear the arguments for that. So Frank Olson, he was actually assigned to be a guide while he was in the CIA for George Hunter White. Now, George Hunter White was this massive dude who worked for the OSS during World War II under Alan Dulles. And he was this killer. He had perfected a one-blow punch with his fist that could kill a man. And what White would do was he would set up safe houses where they could drug up prostitutes for Operation Midnight Climax, for MK Ultra sub-projects, right? Then one technique is that they would use is to find out if the target of someone they're trying to assassinate, if they drink a lot. Because if they do, you could inject them with morphine because it's hard to detect, and the cause of death would be called acute alcoholism. Which, again, if you think back to all the conspiracies about different celebrities dying, and you may think, huh, I wonder if that's what happened. Maybe, right? So the book, it abruptly switches over to the assassination manual. That's what was in the assassination manual. Another technique in the manual, they say if you have to kill someone with a rifle, the ideal distance is 100 to 250 yards with a bolt action and long range cartridge. And the examples given in the book are all non-military rounds, because military rounds are full metal jacketed, which they don't expand, so they're less lethal. But anyways, if you think about old Charlie Kay, he was, in accordance with the assassination manual, those numbers all fit, by the way. So back to Sidney Gottlieb. Sidney Gottlieb is messing with stuff, and he hires a magician, John Mulholland, to teach sleight of hand. Because again, him and George Hunter White are trying to set up these things where they can dose people so they can do these experiments. And here's basically where we get into the Operation Often stuff about the occult, right? You start talking about magic right now and sleight of hand. Over to Dr. Cameron. He was inspired by a doctor named Frank Kelman. And Frank Kelman wanted to sterilize every single person in a family if someone had schizophrenia or any kind of, you know, minor handicaps or whatever. But, you know, back then, they were really into eugenics, right? I don't know about the 60s, but for sure in the 20s and 30s. And apparently this guy wouldn't let it go. And that just gives you the mindset of a lot of these psychopaths. And you're thinking, man, how could you do this stuff to unwilling victims? Well, because they're psycho nerds. Psycho nerds. So Dr. Cameron, he also was into electroshock. He wanted to electroshock women into being good housewives. Crazy stuff going on, right? Dr. Cameron was also abusive with psychic driving. He would do psychic driving techniques up to 20 hours a day. You know, and this is like whispering into someone's ear for 20 hours a day. It's insane. So anyways, Buckley, he gets sent to do training with this hypnotist, and he's there for a week, and he's so successful at hypnotizing that he hypnotizes the magician's wife into having sex with him. I'm trying to think of the words I can say on YouTube. Sorry, guys. They love self-censorship, so I got to do it. But anyways, he hypnotizes the magician's wife into doing it with him, but then he supposedly snaps her out of the trance before she took her clothes off. I mean, that's what he said, right? And it's interesting that they would be studying occult aspects through Operation Often, and how it typically went towards sex or sex-related themes. So either these guys were just horny nerds, horny psychic nerds, the worst, horny psycho nerds, or there's a sex magic element they're not telling us about. All right. Then the book, we're going through the book, right? It's 1969 now. And Alan Dulles wakes up dead. This is just a few years after JFK had him fired, by the way. There's also more chemical germ leaks in Okinawa that are affecting servicemen and the local Japanese kids. And the Japanese were like, you need to get this crap out of here. All this, they had VX nerve gas and stuff. And Nixon was like, okay. Nixon was like, let's destroy all the chemicals, actually. Except for the ones with the mind-controlled drugs, right, for MK Ultra. He was cool with that. The rest of them, they had to go. So Gottlieb, he ends up taking over the Office of Research and Development for the CIA, and this is where the things get weird. This is where Operation Often happens. And page 295 is the first mention of Operation Often through the ORD. And they only budgeted 150 grand back in 69. So, I mean, you know, not a terrible ton of money. But the reason they called it Operation Often is because Gottlieb reminded colleagues often that they were close to goals before pulling back. And often they forgot the only scientific way forward was to learn from the past. And none of those things should happen in Operation Often. Kind of a goofy, I would have called it Operation Black Magic or something cool. But that's the point. They don't want you to know what the operation's about by the name of it in case it gets discovered. So it would go back in time to the mind control research and the earlier supernatural elements near the beginning of the MKUltra project. And it said the project will aim to create a new kind of psycho-civilized human being. In the book, it describes it as Gottlieb's own Frankenstein. And of course, you know, Frankenstein being one of the most occulted tales of all time, inspired by alchemy and the Gollum. And what these researchers were doing was they would visit palm readers, fortune tellers, and so on, and they would introduce themselves as researchers from the Scientific Engineering Institute, right? The cover name. And a lot, well, not a lot, some of the astrologers, some of the psychics, of course, they were frauds, as you would expect. And in October 1970, they thought about actually planting some psychics near the Soviet bloc to tune in. But they didn't, pick up on the energies of what was happening in the Soviet Union. But like it said it would take too long for them to learn Russian, so they bailed on that. They also had a medium go into the United Nations building in New York City and walk around with a camera and take photos of people that they felt had evil personalities. They tried to get palm prints of Fidel Castro to do a palm reading. One time, without telling the palm readers, they did get a palm reading of Fidel Castro, and they didn't tell some of the palm readers what it was. And the palm readers would say, well, this is a born leader or a male with strong homosexual leanings. And from this, you could get into all this propaganda that they would use, right? This fear of him being outed, if that was the truth, whatever. And what's funny is in JFK, they even talked about how Joe Pesci's character talks about how they could give Fidel Castro some kind of drug that he would lose his beard. And we're actually going to talk about that on the next episode when we go through the weaponry that Dr. Sidney Gottlieb was cooking up at the CIA. So these psychics, they were put on the payroll, but they wanted them to predict the future. And some of them were successful. One predicted that Richard Nixon would get reelected, but it would end in turmoil. One predicted that the Vietnam War would end in disaster for the United States, and so on. But here's where it gets interesting, okay? On page 298 of the book, they say the operation often went deep into demonology, and they had contacted priests who were doing exorcisms. It doesn't give you any more details than that, though. Sorry. There's not a ton on Operation Often in this book, which I was a little bit dismayed by. They also contacted Sybil Leek, and she was a sorceress from Houston who could cast spells. Now, this also made me think of Charlie Kay, and you remember that Jezebel article about someone putting a witch hex through Etsy on Charlie Kay. Remember that? We talked about it on my show. Now, Sybil Leek, she claimed to descend from a line of genuine white witches, so there was some supposed truth to all this, and she had a crow, a jackdaw, as they call it, called Mr. Hotfoot Jackson with her. And she would tell the CIA that the U.S. had 400 covens in operation with over 5,000 witches and warlocks, and that Satan was thriving in America. And she would know because she was in this community, right? She was a big name. So it's interesting that the U.S. government would spend and the press would spend so much effort trying to dismiss Satanism in America with the satanic panic of the 80s, right? So Gottlieb would end up financing a course in sorcery at the University of South Carolina with 250 students enrolled in lessons on fertility and initiation rites and necromancy, right? And that's basically it for Often. But let's not forget that McGowan's whole book that we talked about in part one, Program to Kill, was about satanic groups and rituals that the CIA did, right? And so again, this is like everything else. They want to, like UFOs, it's like, nah, that's crazy talk. Meanwhile, they're going deep. They're going hard in the paint behind the scenes on it, including chaos magic. In the book, it talks about an Often, Operation Often, they would do chaos magic and they would have psychonauts travel into the void. And this goes into language of, you know, Twin Peaks, right? Twin Peaks is all about intelligence, FBI, right? Dale Cooper going into the void. And they said that in the void was where you could access the most powerful magic of all to destroy any enemy. And Gottlieb wanted to do this, right? He was into this. So he paid someone to attempt it, but he paid the money and the guy just ran off. We don't know. Did the guy die? Did he fall into the void? Did he lose his mind? Was he a scammer? The book doesn't know. But that's kind of it for Operation Often. There's not a ton. It's fascinating. It was done at all. And it brings out all the hot button terms that we talk about all the time. Satanism and witchcraft and going into the void and psychonauts and chaos magic. I believe that all this will fit into the research theories and claims about Jack Parsons, the Collins Elite, ufology, and the understanding of how they can control reality through occult practices, which I've talked about for so many years, right? To keep going, let's finish the book off and we're going to wrap up. In June 1972, Sidney Gottlieb gets back into... He sort of goes hard in the paint on mind control, then pulls out, then gets into the occult, then he kind of settles back into brain implants. Dr. Robert Heath at Tulane was experimenting with electrodes called ESB, electrical stimulation of the brain. And ESB could stimulate a man's pleasure center for hours, control their memory, their impulses, their feelings, and manipulate human will. And Gottlieb loves this. From this, he was like, this is it. He sees a world where every human thought, emotion, and desire could be controlled. He called this the psycho-civilized society. And Gottlieb hires Dr. Stephen Aldrich to try to figure out this whole, how to do this on a mass scale. And Aldrich also thought that he could bring their dreams with Dr. Cameron into reality to electrically monitor people through brain chips. And if you're thinking ahead, you're like, hey, wait a minute. What's Elon Musk trying to do? What's he trying to do? That's right. The Neuralink brain chip seems interesting to me, right? And Elon Musk is the biggest welfare queen of all. He's got nothing but government contracts. So tell me that won't be part of the plan. Tell me that these people weren't in the same room at some time. Now it's September 1972. The CIA is panicking to figure out how, because one of the victims from Ewan Cameron, Mary Morrow, she was pursuing legal action against him for drilling into her brain and torturing her. And CIA Director Richard Helms has Buckley run and check on every patient in this practice to see if any of this could trace back to the CIA. Buckley's like, no, it's fine. So long as nobody finds our paperwork. So Helms like, destroy it all. And that's why all the MKUltra documents got destroyed. And in December 1972, everything gets canceled. January 1973, Gottlieb resigns. Except there was 130 boxes left that did not get destroyed, including the assassination manual in this book, including ties to the mafia, various experiment results, payments to George Hunter White and prostitutes. So William Kobe takes over as director of CIA, and he wants a report of all the sketchy stuff that CIA has been doing. And he finds out about MKUltra. He gets a little taste of it, right? And then Watergate happens and Nixon resigns, just like that gypsy witch said. And the New York Times writes an article in December 1974 about the CIA's past projects of illegal activity going back through Nixon and Johnson. President Gerald Ford starts a commission chaired by Vice President Nelson Rockefeller to investigate these allegations. California Governor Ronald Reagan is on the commission, and he's obsessed with curbing violence. So he was pushing for a solution that was proposed by Dr. Jolly West, who was also involved with MKUltra, to do a study on the reduction of violence to see if violent individuals could be fixed, right? Because Jolly West is like, yeah, I was doing this for years with the CIA. We're trying to put brain chips in these fools, right? Jolly West is like, hey, let's open up a lab in the Santa Monica Mountains, and I'm going to hit you with that brain electrode action, right? Let's get you with them brain chips. And Dr. West promised Ronald Reagan that someday the government could monitor the actions of all people who had these brain chips. Again, Neuralink. And Jolly West wanted more MKUltra type stuff. And Reagan, he was about that action. He was like, hell yeah, let's do it. But the commission shoots him down. The commission report drops and Reagan dissents. And he's like, hey, these CIA guys do nothing wrong. And he's like, oh, these poor CIA agents, they're fighting with one hand tied behind their back. And Reagan was like, I vow that if I become president, I'll make sure that the CIA can do whatever they want because they're the good guys. Meanwhile, President Ford's dealing with CIA fallout and signs an order that he's like, look, no more assassinations, no more ever again, right? And then you got the whole history of how the MKUltra stuff got investigated. And they're like, all right, there's not enough info. We don't know what happened. And as we'll find out in the next part, Gottlieb is like, I don't know what's going on. I forget what happened. You know, that we never got the truth. Then in 1985, William Buckley gets taken hostage by Hezbollah and he is killed in action overseas. And that's kind of where the book ends. In conclusion, to me, the value of this book in our MKUltra deep dive is the small section on Operation Often. Because this is the part that proves the intelligence agencies were exploring the occult. And from here, you can see how a Collins Elite could be real that I talked about in my alien books. You could see how all of the connections between the secret societies, intelligence agencies, ufology, this could all go back through John Dee and Enoch. And even further down the rabbit hole, you could argue these same elements tie us into eschatology and the studies to bring about the end times. Through the rebuilding of the Temple of Solomon, it gets crazy. But in the next part, part three, we're going to get into the least sensational source book, the Poisoner in Chief book about Sidney Gottlieb. All right. And this one's going to be really good. It's going to cover the Nazi origins of MKUltra with Operation Paperclip, the origins of the term used in the program. We'll get deeper into stories about George Hunter White and his Operation Midnight Climax with all the freaky freaks up in the CIA. So be sure to stay subscribed to the podcast for part three. And if you haven't watched this on YouTube, if you're a listener, go check out my YouTube at Occult Symbolism. Links are always in the show notes. Get me to 100K by 2027 and I'll shut the heck up. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Till next time, stay positive.